It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy released a multi-year plan this week to spend more than $50 million on maintaining, rehabilitating, and operating Pittsburgh's 165 parks. But the plan is contingent on the November passage of a ballot initiative to create a Parks Trust Fund. The Confluence's Megan Harris spoke with Jane Miller, president and CEO of the Parks Conservancy.
In April, you were on the Confluence to talk about the Conservancy's listening tour, where you were gathering data from every park in the city about needs and health indicators. You said then that almost everyone wanted to see the parks better maintained. So would you say that this plan then is the natural outcropping of that?
I would. As I mentioned when I was here in April, we're really looking at two sets of information. One is the data, which is what are the park conditions and what are the needs in the communities that surround those parks. And then the second really critical piece is what does the public want? What are their priorities? And so it's taking the investment strategy, takes the data and what the public told were their priorities, and developing the strategy based on that.
So what did you hear? What projects are now on the list?
The plan covers four major areas in parks: rehabilitation and capital improvements, maintenance, and programming. What we heard from the public, their number one priority was to spend money on maintenance. So that is getting the biggest share of dollars. And then closely behind that is rehab and parks, where we can't necessarily get to a capital major transformation for a number of years, but we can do some work to repair and restore and make safe amenities that are in parks. And then capital investments was the third most important category, and programming was the fourth.
What is the need? How bad are the bad ones? What kinds of projects are you looking at?
Well, so we know that we have a minimum of a $400 million capital backlog across all 165 parks. It's large. It's a lot. We also know that on an annual basis, we're short $13 million a year. One of the things that people say is, well, why do you have to get additional money? And I say to people, well, first of all, we know we have a $13 million shortfall in maintenance. If you take the $400 million minimum backlog and say divide it by 20 years to get it fixed in 20 years, that's $20 million a year. So $20 million plus $13 million is additional $33 million a year. It's more than we can raise as a conservancy. It's more than the city has available. So the question really is, do voters want to see these improvements in their parks, which we believe they do, and then how best to do it, because it's not going to be fixed overnight, and we need to really look at a long-term strategy of all four areas of making investments.
And part of that long-term strategy, of course, is a potential tax increase. Mm-hmm. Why was it important to do it through a ballot referendum and let the citizens decide?
Because parks are owned by the citizens of Pittsburgh, and so my perspective is, let the citizens tell us how important it is that we make these additional investments. So that's the reason. It's also the same reason why we've been doing this huge community engagement process, so we can hear from the public about what their priorities are, and then to share the strategy based on what they told us.
And some of those responses, 3,400, I believe, in total, and at least one person vouched for every single park in the system. As you're looking at those, how do you decide what is the most critical right now?
So again, as part of the public input, we gave residents a list of a variety of maintenance practices, probably 10 or 15 of them.
Such as?
Mowing, trash collection, snow and ice removal, graffiti removal, path clearing, sidewalk maintenance.
All stuff that has to be done on a fairly regular basis.
Absolutely. We also gave them a list of amenities, swimming pools, paths, sidewalks, playgrounds, to say how important are these to you? And from the maintenance side, what's most important to maintain? Do certain maintenance activities rank higher than others for you? And when you look at the four areas of investments, maintenance, capital, rehab, and programming, how do they stack against each other? So we first heard maintenance was first most important. And then within maintenance, people prioritize what were the most important maintenance activities. So the dollars that we're going to acquire for maintenance is about $22 million over a six-year period of time. That's a 20% increase in funding for maintenance. And the public has identified which are most important. So we'll increase the service level in every park across the city in those high-ranked maintenance activities.
Were you surprised at all by any of the respondents? What is most important to Pittsburghers?
You know, not really. Most of them, I wasn't surprised. What's interesting is people struggle prioritizing one maintenance activity over another.
It does seem a little like choosing a child.
Yes, exactly. What I can tell you is that all of the maintenance activities were rated as somewhat important or most important by at least 82%. So again, it tells you that all those activities are really important. One that was really high on the list that I was really pleased to see was tree care and tree planting. So I think people recognize the value of the tree canopy in Pittsburgh.
Are there any parks or particular pieces of the park system that you personally are excited to see maybe come back to life?
You know, for me, it's the system of parks. It's not one individual park, mm-hmm. because I really believe strongly parks make such a difference in people's lives that it's not one park. It's making a difference across the whole city for all residents in Pittsburgh.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, joined by Jane Miller, CEO of the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy, which just announced a plan to help address what it estimates is a $400 million capital backlog. Jane, of course, all this upkeep and maintenance takes money. The proposed trust fund would be supported by an increase in real estate taxes, about a half mil, so $50-ish per $100,000 of assessed real estate value, as well as matching funds from the Conservancy and other organizations. How much money do you estimate that this would ultimately raise for the parks?
So if we are able to be successful in having the referendum on the ballot, and then if voters approve it, we're talking about an additional almost $10 million a year. We're also hoping to raise private dollars to the tune of $10 million a year as well, particularly for the first 10 years. So if we are able to bring in an additional $20 million a year, that's significant. That's more than a one-third increase over what the city is currently able to spend on parks and what the Conservancy is able to spend today.
How much of a struggle is it to raise money for public parks?
So, you know, when you care about something and you're passionate about it, it's easy to ask for money because you can make the connections. The research that's out there, the impact that parks make in people's lives for their health and wellness, for economic development for a city, for environmental sustainability, I can spout all that stuff out to people, and people really care about that. And one of the really big pieces is people really know from their own adults, from their own history, how important parks were to them. And so the legacy of making these investments in parks for their kids and their grandkids, people get it and know it because they remember their experience as kids in parks.
The last time we talked on this program, you mentioned that the Conservancy plans to develop a transparent investment strategy so the public knows how money is set aside to maintain and manage the park system. Of course, that was all released this week. Where can people find the plan?
It's up on our website. If you go to pittsburghparks.org, you'll see all of the documents that show the detail of how we're going to spend maintenance money, how we're going to spend rehab money, capital money. You'll see the park rankings. You'll see the walk shed. You'll see how every park scored for capital only. People have a tendency to focus on the park rankings, thinking that that's the only area of money, but that's only to determine their order for spending money on capital. But every park will see investments in maintenance, rehab, capital, and programming.
And programming, how exciting is it to you, again, as the head of the system, to put some money back into some ongoing strategies to engage the public?
Really, really important. So on the programming side, you know, we have senior centers and recreation centers across the city who really have been struggling to deliver services. They've had reduced hours, the facilities need improvements. And so by making these investments, they can expand their programming, have their facilities open longer hours, provide really safe places for kids and families to go to experience positive activity in their neighborhoods.
For that programming piece, what's the rollout plan? Would that happen, you know, several years down the line? Could it happen in a stair-step way or all at once in the beginning?
Right. Probably the two areas that we can start most quickly is maintenance and programming. A lot of it is hiring more staff and having more programming on the programming side and on the maintenance side, getting more equipment. So I think those are the two areas we can roll out the most quickly. The capital and rehab will take more planning and community engagement. But for sure, in 2020, if we're successful with this initiative, you'll see improvements in the maintenance in the parks and expanded programming in 2020.
So to actually get this referendum on the ballot, you need signatures. What is it, 12,500?
Yeah, just under that.
So you began collecting signatures in June. Are you close to that goal now?
We're probably 500 signatures short of what we need. We're going to continue to gather signatures through the beginning of August. We have to submit any of the signed petitions by August 6th to the County Elections Board.
Have you received any pushback yet from local officials or even residents who maybe aren't sure about this plan yet?
Yeah, I mean, some people are concerned, obviously, because of the tax increase. Completely understandable. Some people are concerned about the management of it, how the dollars will be spent. I feel very proud of the fact of the level of community engagement we've had and how transparent we've been through this process. And people can see everything in terms of our plan for investments. What's not out there yet, but I will have by the end of August, is a very clear management strategy, governance strategy, which we're finalizing with the city right now, where we will have a board of directors made up of city officials and conservancy officials who will be responsible for oversight and management of the actual trust fund itself, but just finalizing those documents right now.
And regarding city officials, city council, of course, most of them have not weighed in yet. Fourth District Representative Anthony Coghill said he does not support the plan as is. Is it important to you to get them on board as this process evolves?
Absolutely. I mean, I'd love to have the elected officials on board. I also appreciate everyone has different perspectives, which is, again, another reason why, from my perspective, this is land that is owned by the citizens. We, the Conservancy and the city, are stewards of that land, but let the voters decide if they want to make additional investments in their parks.
So what would you say then to maybe a skeptical voter, someone who's maybe unsure of that tax increase at this point?
I would say go to our website, look at all of the information. If you have questions, let us know. We're holding a series of what are called Park Listening 2 meetings. Those are also posted on our website. So attend one of those meetings, comments, and ask questions. It's important to me that people understand what we're trying to do, what we've laid out, and the strategy for doing it, and let voters decide whether they feel comfortable with that approach.
That's 12 public meetings through July and August. We'll have links to that calendar as well as the full plan on our website at WESA.FM. Jane, I'm curious, what is the plan if the referendum ultimately gets to the ballot but doesn't pass?
Well, if it doesn't pass, we will continue to do what we've been doing for the last 50 years, which is kind of cobble things together and hope that we can do the best we can with the resources we have.
Jane Miller is the president and CEO of the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy. Jane, thanks so much for dropping by.
Thanks very much. Appreciate being here.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski, still ahead on The Confluence. With residential development already making its way into Homewood, will those coming back have a place to live? And 50 years ago, the Apollo 11 mission was on its way to the moon. We'll hear from a then 22-year-old engineer who was on the ground, and Michael Collins, the astronaut who piloted the mothership. Find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence on our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
Have you been looking for an excuse to go dancing in the streets? Today would be the perfect day for it, and it has nothing to do with this heat wave. Martha Reeves of Martha and the Vandellas was born on this day in 1941. Their song, Dancin' in the Streets, is one of the most loved and most covered in the history of rock and roll, with excellent versions from the Rolling Stones, David Bowie, and of course the Grateful Dead, who have had it in their repertoire since the earliest days of the group. The song you're hearing now, Heatwave, considered to be the first to signify the Motown sound. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
Are there fewer fireflies lighting up summer nights than there were when you were a kid? This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsoppel. Like many other insects, fireflies or lightning bugs are declining.
There seem to be fewer, but I'm wondering if it's because of all the light in the world we have now and things that folks use on their yards and that.
Julie Cicchini is a self-proclaimed lover of bugs, and her questions led her to sign up for a recent citizen science firefly watch training at Beechwood Farms Nature Reserve run by the Audubon Society of Western Pennsylvania. Andy Cubis went along to learn more.
The Pyractomena glows amber.
You don't have to go to a class to become a volunteer for firefly watch, but if you do, you'll learn a lot. For starters, they aren't bugs or flies. They are bioluminescent beetles that light up because of a chemical reaction in their abdomen.
This one does two flashes in a row. Flash, flash. Then he waits 4 seconds, flash, flash. This one does a flash, 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 flash. So they can tell one from the other by the pattern of the flash and the length of the flash.
This is Scott Detweiler, a nature educator at Beechwood Farms. He's leading a small group through a firefly watch training. There are three common varieties in Pennsylvania. The one you see the most often is the Photinus pyralis, also known as the Big Dipper, because it makes a J-shaped swoop as it lights up. Fireflies use their bioluminescent signals to find and attract mates, kind of like a silent love song. The male flashes, and the female, hanging out in a tall blade of grass, sends a signal back saying, yeah, you seem good. Come introduce yourself.
See, do we see any that are sitting on foliage? These guys are all moving. That's the adults. But see, there's one down here. See one sitting? And she's just doing a flash.
After a quick lesson on firefly behavior and mating rituals, Detweiler leads the group outside to practice the very simple protocol. All you need is a stopwatch and a couple of minutes once a week to do some counting.
You just kind of pick your spot, and just within your field of vision, how many do you see? All right, and that's all there is to it. So let's set one up. Let's do a 10-second count, and we'll see what numbers we come up with. Beginning now.
We all stare into the same patch of darkness to observe. We're not counting specific fireflies, just how many flashes we see in the 10 seconds.
Okay, stop. How many did you see?
Eight.
15. 12. Yeah, there was nothing for the first 3 seconds, and then they all went crazy after that.
At home, volunteers repeat 3 times within a few minutes and then record the numbers on a form, along with a few data points like weather conditions, habitat type, and if any artificial light is around. Whenever it's convenient, participants upload their data to a website maintained by Mass Audubon. It gets passed on to firefly researchers who are trying to learn more about the geographic distribution of fireflies and which environmental factors impact their numbers. Maya Haber came to the training with her husband, Sean Guillory, and her 8-year-old daughter, Zoya. Haber is from Israel, and she says for her, just seeing fireflies feels like a novelty.
I didn't even know that they existed until I came to the U.S. Like, I'd never seen them before.
It's okay, I didn't know they existed until I left California.
I just saw an amber one.
Dude, there's a flying one.
Some fireflies begin flashing at dusk and blink for less than an hour. Others start later and keep at it until midnight or so. But they'll all continue lighting up the night sky through the end of the summer. Detweiler, from Beechwood Farms, says if you like fireflies, you can do some things to encourage them to come to your yard. Plant grasses and shrubs of varying heights, don't use pesticides, and turn off the porch light. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Andy Kubis.
That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Housing is a central tenet of Homewood's development efforts, but formerly incarcerated people often find themselves being locked out, even of homes built with federal money. As part of our Homewood Bound series, 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley reports that it's hard for those returning from prison to find a place to stay.
Doug Williams isn't shy about his past struggles with drugs.
My pastor always said it, you got to go through a test to have a testimony.
Growing up in Homewood, he says he went from playing sports to getting high.
Anything and everything, but the main one was crack, powder, cocaine, and heroin.
After several stints in jail, he's now considered a success story in the neighborhood. He got clean and turned his life around. He's currently a program coordinator at the Greater Pittsburgh YMCA, where he helps other young men returning from prison or jail.
We have to provide more homes, affordable homes for men, because it allows them to become self-sufficient.
In Pennsylvania, 2 out of every 3 people released from prison go back within 3 years. Access to stable and affordable housing helps this population stay out of jail. But finding a home isn't that easy.
We have a lot of trouble finding apartments that individuals can afford after they leave our system.
Department of Health and Human Services Cynthia Shields says Allegheny County tries to provide a safety net of housing services. The county has what it calls a housing first model and works with about 30 organizations that find housing for people with records. They offer rental assistance and work with case managers to make sure tenants are paying rent and meeting requirements to, for example, stay sober or attend anger therapy. Still, Shields says,
finding landlords that will rent to our programs is a challenge for us.
Some landlords don't want to go through the county property inspection. Others stigmatize ex-offenders and worry how they might behave as tenants. Will they pay rent? Will they take care of the unit? Finding a home can be a challenge, even in government-subsidized housing. On the corner of Hamilton and North Lang Avenues, bulldozers screech near a line of tall, wood-framed homes. Reverend Ricky Burgess is proud of this project, which includes 58 rental units. He's the city council member who represents Homewood.
The goal is to take Homewood, which is a community of concentrated poverty, and transform it into a stable mixed-income community.
Tenants can apply to live here through the city's housing authority. The smallest unit rents for $900 a month. But former offenders would be unlikely to find a home here. The housing authority sharply limits access for ex-offenders, so other residents feel safe. Burgess says projects like this are directed at a larger population.
The greatest need is affordable housing, period. And that housing for people coming home for reintegration is a subsection of that need. It is not the biggest need, but it is a need.
Homewood activist Shirley Fuller says such policies don't consider the likely influx of formerly incarcerated people moving into the neighborhood.
No, it's not a priority. Because all we're talking about is affordable housing. Can you afford it? If an individual is just coming home from incarceration, are they at that plateau to where they can afford a $900 a month bedroom?
That's a steep rent for many Homewood residents, but those who receive rental assistance may be able to afford it. But once again, the formerly incarcerated can't take advantage of this aid. So applicants with records have to find willing private landlords.
In a few places where we know that there are those type of housing, we don't sort of broadcast it.
Fuller says that's because residents could be stigmatized or targeted, and neighbors could be vulnerable too. That's the case for Dwayne Drummond, the formerly incarcerated window installer we met earlier in the series. He didn't want to say where he lived because he wasn't on the lease due to his record.
You know what I mean? This is not my house. You know what I mean? This is my girl's house. And that's the truth. You know what I mean? Can't get nothing in your name. You know what I mean? Because you want people to have reentry into society, and you're blackballing from jobs, blackballing from housing.
As Homewood tries to work through the troubles in its past, Fuller says it should consider how the formerly incarcerated can fit into its future.
Regardless of who it is, it's our responsibility to put our arms around everybody.
I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
You can find more on this series at wesa.fm/homewoodbound. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. For President Trump, delivering on a promise to restore Presque Isle's beaches was a chance to boost his environmental credentials. But advocacy groups say that success ends at the water's edge. 90.5 WESA's Lucy Perkins reports.
President Trump went off his usual talking points at a rally in Erie last fall. He told the crowd about a request from the town's Republican Congressman Mike Kelly.
Mike keeps calling, "Sir, we want to fix up Presque Isle." I said, "Mike, what the hell is Presque Isle?"
Presque Isle State Park is a sandy peninsula that stretches into Lake Erie. Its beaches are a popular tourist destination, but waves wash away Presque Isle's shoreline. Kelly told Trump they need federal funding to rebuild the beaches every year.
He said, "I'll tell you what, let me know how much you need." And I said, "Well, we're going to need at least $1.5 million. He goes, "That's all, $1.5 million? I said, yeah, it's a lot of money. It buys a lot of sand.
68,000 cubic yards of sand. The sand replenishment project has gotten federal money before, but Kelly emphasized how important it is to prioritize the project before summer tourism hits.
He understood it right away. Once you tell him something, you can see it. It's like you can almost hear everything clicking behind. He said, you got to have that.
Mike Asquith manages the project for the Army Corps of Engineers. He says they started earlier than they have in years past.
Last year, the budget was passed very early in the season. The work plan was put together early in the season. We got the funding, and that we were able to get out here relatively quickly.
As he watches truck after truck unload sand, Congressman Kelly praises President Trump for understanding Erie's needs.
This beach is an incredible asset to have. These people that come to visit, they just don't come to the beach and then go in the water and leave. They buy gasoline. They stay in hotels and motels. They buy food here. They go to restaurants here. So again, that economic impact is critical.
Experts say the sand replenishes the habitat for native species, and environmental groups say it's important to give credit where credit is due. But
in no way, shape, or form can anyone spin the environmental track record of this administration as anything other than abysmal and needing to change.
Jordan Lebetkin is with the Healing Our Waters Project at the Great Lakes Coalition. He says the lakes are being harmed in multiple ways, both by things the Trump administration is and is not doing. For example, the Environmental Protection Agency is rolling back clean water protections that keep pollutants out of waterways, including those that drain into the Great Lakes. And at the same time, he says the administration is not addressing climate change. It pulled out of an historic global climate agreement in 2017. Ignoring climate change could make things worse in the Great Lakes. Changing weather means more heavy rains and flooding.
And what happens is you get increased runoff. This can be from farm fields when fertilizers and excess manure run off into ditches and streams, into rivers, and eventually the Great Lakes. And you get harmful and toxic algal blooms,
which can make people and wildlife sick, and in some cases create unsafe drinking water. 5 years ago, an algal bloom forced the city of Toledo to warn residents away from drinking tap water. Algal blooms can hurt tourism, too. Matt Green is the park manager at Presque Isle.
We had a really big bloom last year on 4th of July out at our most popular beach here. So we did have to close that one down on probably one of the busiest days we have.
On that same beach a year later, Congressman Kelly applauds the president's record.
I think he has a great concern for the environment, and he'll be the first one to tell you that these all have an economic impact. No, he's very aware of it.
Kelly endorsed Trump's withdrawal from the climate treaty, and he acknowledges the administration's attempts to cut other Great Lakes funding. But he says there's only so much money they have to work with, so you have to focus on projects with a quick return. I'm Lucy Perkins, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. 50 years ago, astronauts Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins were on board a Saturn V rocket launched from Florida, heading to the moon. WPSU's Christine Allen spoke with a Penn State professor who worked with NASA on that historic launch.
It was the morning of July 16, 1969. Legendary CBS anchorman Walter Cronkite was in a Florida studio near the launch site bright and early. The Saturn V rocket stood next to the launch tower on the screen behind him.
At 9:32 a.m. Eastern Time, that huge 36-story high launch vehicle is scheduled to thunder to life, pushing the astronauts into temporary orbit around the Earth. And 2.5 hours later, another rocket burn will send the spacecraft on its way to the moon.
Well, the night before the launch, we spent testing everything on Apollo 11.
Denny Gioia is professor of management in Penn State's Smill College of Business, but his bachelor's degree was in engineering. At the age of 22, while working for Boeing, he was assigned to work with NASA on the Apollo program, and he was there at the launch site in Florida on the day Apollo 11 soared into space.
But I had gone home around midnight because they told us to go home. Well, that was ridiculous. You just couldn't go to sleep. So I, in the middle of the night sometime, I headed back to Cape Kennedy just to see what was going on. It was just a beehive of activity.
Launch operations manager Paul Donner reports go for launch.
Gioia had been assigned to Apollo 12, so he was part of the backup team for Apollo 11. That meant he did not have to stay inside a building called the firing room with the launch team.
That was a good thing. I was lucky because I could be outside and experience the launch. And the closest anybody was allowed, besides the rescue team and the astronauts themselves, was 3.1 miles away. So a lot of us, along with a lot of muckety-mucks, VIPs, were standing between the vehicle assembly building and the launch pad.
1-0, all engine running. Liftoff, we have a liftoff, 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Saturn generates 7.5 million pounds of thrust to lift a 6.4 million pound vehicle off the ground. It's a controlled explosion. And then the ground was shaking. It's like an earthquake, and that's what it felt like through your feet.
Building shaking. We're getting that buffeting we've become used to.
I was standing 3 miles away with a camera on a tripod, telephoto lens, and I had not been warned about the shockwave. And it rolled in from the launch pad and began to vibrate me, so I had trouble holding the tripod still. What I didn't realize was that I had positioned myself between the launch pad and the vehicle assembly building. The shockwave hit the VAB and bounced off, came back and got me from the other side. It was a struggle.
What a moment. Man on the way to the moon.
And this historic flight would be a resounding success. Less than 5 days later, on July 20th, 1969, a human being would, for the first time, set foot on another world.
That was WPSU's Christine Allen speaking with Penn State professor Denny Gioia, who worked for NASA during the Apollo 11 mission. We remember Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, the first and second astronauts to set foot on the lunar surface. The other member of that Apollo 11 team was flying the spacecraft orbiting above. Michael Collins is now 88 years old. I talked to him many moons ago, shortly after the 19th anniversary of the Apollo mission, which he captured in his 1988 book, Liftoff.
When you're going on a historic mission like that, was there a moment, a portion of the whole program, if you will, that you were most concerned about?
Well, the flight to the moon and back, I always think of such a flight as a very long and fragile daisy chain. I mean, you break any link in that chain and the whole thing is broken. The link that I thought was the weakest and the one that worried me the most was the rendezvous process, getting Armstrong and Aldrin off the surface of the moon at exactly the right time into exactly the right orbit. Now, when that was done, the rendezvous itself was fairly simple, but had they been late or had they wobbled up into some sort of a lopsided orbit, then I might have been able to go get them and I might not have. It just depended. And that was the part that I was sweating out, I think, more than any other part of the flight.
How big was the Apollo spaceship and how big was the lunar module that we're hooking up and, you know, the delicate process involved?
Well, they were heavy machines because they were full of fuel. They were fairly small. They were the lunar module was cramped with two people inside. The command module had room for three. I was in it by myself, sort of rattling around loose, you might say, when Armstrong and Aldrin were down on the surface of the moon. But I was overhead in an orbit 60 miles above the surface of the moon. And if they take off exactly on time, then they go up into an orbit that's 45 miles above the surface, and that difference of 15 miles is carefully calculated so that they can catch up with me at exactly the right rate. If they're late, well, then they have to go faster and faster, and the way you do that in orbit is by going lower and lower. So they get to the point where they're just skimming the lunar mountaintops trying to catch me because they were late getting off and had to make up the time. Then if you're just 1 second later than that, you can't go any lower, then that strategy suddenly reverses itself. And then they had to go as high as they could and slow down as much as they could. And then I had to dive down for the mountains and make an extra turn around the moon and catch them instead of vice versa. And all this gets very complicated, and that's a part of the flight that I didn't like thinking about. I just hoped everything was going to work okay, and as it turned out, it did.
Before the actual landing on the moon, you describe the 3D picture of the moon that you were seeing as you approached, rather than that flat two-dimensional thing that we're used to seeing. Was it difficult to do justice in your writing of the description of that?
I think it was, because the moon that you see out over your back fence looks nothing at all like the moon that we saw up close. In the first place, we didn't see the moon getting bigger and bigger, because one of the requirements was that we line ourselves up broadside to the sun and then rotate like a chicken on a barbecue spit. And that was necessary to keep the heat coming from the sun evenly distributed around all sides of our spacecraft. Well, when you do that, the moon is not in your window. So for 3 days on the way to the moon, we did not see it. Now, when we stopped this barbecue rotation and swung around and the moon came into view, it was just totally different than anything I had seen before. An awesome spectacle. It filled our whole window and its belly bulged out toward us. You could really see that it was a sphere and not a little flat plate up there. The sunlight was cascading around its rim and then hitting the Earth and bouncing back. And we were in a twilight zone that was almost an eerie sort of a purplish blue in color. And it was just totally different region, a different sensation than anything any of the three of us had ever experienced before.
When you came back to Earth, President Nixon welcomed you with such comments as, "This has been the greatest week in history since creation." How old were you at that point?
I was, I was 38.
Okay. What I'm getting at is, here you are, a man of 38 has just experienced, really been part of something that no one has been part of before. After some of the initial exhilaration was gone, on a personal note, did you say, "Boy, I'm 38. Now what do I do?" In a sense that, can anything top this?
Well, I think, in a sense, you could say that being on that flight was like being on a Super Bowl football team. You're on your quarterback in the Super Bowl one year, you got a bad knee the next year. It's that kind of thing. I think the challenge is to go through the rest of your life finding interesting work, things that are going to keep your mind occupied about your future and not scratching your head and ruminating about the past and boring all your friends with the same old repetitious stories about what you used to do.
The first administrator of NASA, Keith Glennon, he announces the idea of Project Mercury. What was the important development then going from a one-seater Mercury then to going to Gemini? What other things had to be considered then? And what was the importance of really having the second astronaut along?
Well, Project Gemini really was what answered the questions that remained after Mercury in regard to the moon. And we had several. The first and most important was, can you keep people up in space long enough to get to the moon and back without some bad thing happening physically or physiologically to them? The second was this question of rendezvous. Can two vehicles find each other in the darkness of space? You can't say, meet me over downtown Pittsburgh. You need some other way of getting together. And then the third was, of course, walking on the moon, which you could not duplicate in Earth orbit, but you could go outside and get all the experience that you needed with pressure suits and so on during spacewalks. So you just added up the list of chores to be done, of research that had to be finished before you could go to the moon. Then it spoke for a two-man rather than a one-man crew.
Does the U.S. space program need the Soviets and vice versa? Is it good other than diplomatic reasons to work together?
If you want to go to Mars, for example, Mars is the closest thing to a sister planet that we Earthlings have. If you want to go to Mars, I think it would be nice to visit a planet in the name of all the inhabitants of this one, not just one nation, not just the Americans, although if it had to be one nation, I would prefer that it be ours. But even better than that, I think, or a voyage done by the two superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union, I think it would be better to have such an expedition be done in the name of all the nations of the world. Now, you can't really throw one crew member from every country on board. That's not possible. Mm-hmm. But to get contributions from those who have the money and the technology, the Japanese, certainly the Europeans and the Soviets, and launch an international expedition.
Are you an optimist when it comes to American space?
Oh, yes, I think so. I think it's inevitable that, I know I'm not talking about tomorrow or the next day, but looking way, way, way out into the future, I think it's inevitable that we Earthlings are going to leave this planet sometime and go live in orbit, on the moon, on Mars, perhaps on Titan, one of the moons of Saturn. I think we'll go out through our solar system, and I'm even optimistic enough to think that perhaps we'll figure out some way to avoid Mr. Einstein's speed limit and leave this solar system entirely and find another one.
Retired astronaut Michael Collins is now 88. He spoke with me 31 years ago, shortly after the 19th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon mission, about his book, Liftoff. Tomorrow at this time, an hour-long special celebrating the 50th anniversary of that historic space venture. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Joya Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.